All right, hi, everybody, welcome, and thank you for coming, and thanks for calling in. I'd like to get the meeting started, so I will start by seeing who's on the phone. Did I hear Pat Preston?
Yeah, Pat's on board.
Anybody else on the phone?
This is Jamie Grabowski as well, from Asante in Southern Oregon.
Welcome.
Joan Maka from McMinnville.
Hello, Joan, anybody else?
Laurie Marie Snyder from McMinnville.
Hi, Laurie, anybody else? Okay, well, let's go around the room and introduce ourselves to the group.
Can we start?
Yes, let's start over here.
Okay, sure, sure. Diane Maldo, Hospital Association.
Genevieve Buser with Acute Communicable Disease, HAIT.
Mary Shanks from Kaiser, representing hospitals.
Kate Ellington, also from Communicable Disease.
Sam Spelldown's the same.
Monica Sandler, the same.
Dee Dee Valier, representing the consumer.
Marlene Johnson here, and I'm here as a guest, representing ONA and MPO.
Great. Jordan Perrin, I'm taking over Carl Brown's position on this committee, and I'm representing Ordinance Association.
Kara,
Oh, hi, I'm Kara Middleham, I'm with the Public Health Division and the Public Health Director's Office.
Thank you very much. So has everybody had a chance to look through the minutes from last meeting in December? Does anybody have any requests for changes or corrections? Do I have a move to approve?
So moved.
Second?
Seconded.
Second. Minutes approved. Thank you very much. Okay, so moving along with the agenda on pages 1 through 11, that was the meeting minutes. So on page 12 of your meeting items, we have findings and key recommendations from Oregon's Modernization of Public Health Report. Kara?
Okay, so thank you. Appreciate the time that you're allowing us to have this afternoon. So essentially, I'm just here to help raise awareness about some work that's happening and will be underway to modernize Oregon's public health system. So I think you should have received a one pager that had a little bit of information on it, as well as the presentation for those of you on the phone. Essentially, what I'm going to do is walk through a process that took place over the last year or so that came out of some legislation in 2013, and review for you the key findings and sort of where we are now, because there's some legislation in session, both the House bill and the Senate bill, that would help to operationalize the findings from this report. So essentially, we just want to raise awareness among our stakeholders that this is happening, and because should we have the bill passed, it'll be a kind of a quick timeline to get everything underway. So I'm really informal. Feel free to ask questions or interrupt me as we're going forward. I also realize that the PowerPoint that was sent is quite lengthy. It's probably more information than you really need, so I'm sort of going to skip around in it and kind of skip over a lot of the introductory slides around the public health system in Oregon, and really just start with the task force and its work. So if we go to, I believe it's the sixth slide, back in 2013, House Bill 2348 passed, and essentially this bill originated as a proposal to turn Oregon's local health departments into 8 regional health departments. And I think the legislature quickly recognized that we probably needed a little more time to be thinking about what the impacts might be for the public health system before we went straight to regionalization. So that regionalization concept got changed quickly into the creation of a task force that would study and then propose recommendations to the legislature that would create a public health system for the future, consider how regionalization might fit in with that model, but not have that drive the model. Look for opportunities to enhance efficiency and effectiveness, allow for appropriate partnerships with, for example, CCOs and other emerging partnerships coming out of health system transformation in Oregon, and are supported by best practices. The task force membership was pretty vast. We had county representation, nonprofits, CCO, local public health, other partners, as well as elected officials. And they met monthly between December of 2013 and September of 2014, producing a report that you'll see later on that was submitted at the end of September of 2014 in preparation for the 2015 legislative session. That's the report cover. For those of you in the room, I do have some nice colorful copies if you want the executive summary. I'll leave that on the table. But it's also linked on our website, so you can definitely go and find more information there. So essentially, the task force, before starting to look at some of the other components of the public health system, wanted to establish kind of what's the what. So what is it that the public health system needs to deliver for Oregonians, and how would we get there? So they quickly adopted this conceptual framework for governmental public health services. This is based on some recommendations that come out of the World Health Organization and other national entities. Washington State has used the same model to figure out how they might really focus on these core capabilities and programs. And essentially, the issue is that public health in Oregon, as well as in many other states, relies heavily on federal grants that are often highly prescriptive. They're for specific activities. And we don't really generally have the funds available to support that core work that public health should really be providing. And we leverage money here and there. I know Dr. Cieslak, who joined us for those on the phone, he gave a great example of this related to communicable disease work for the task force a few months ago. But really, we're trying to focus on what the things that public health must deliver for everybody across the state, regardless of whether you live in Multnomah or Morrow County. So the recommendations that came out of the task force were that those foundational capabilities and programs should be adopted. That significant and sustained funding be provided to allow for operationalization of the foundational capabilities of programs, and that we allow local communities to identify their pathway for implementing those. So based on their local partnerships, based on what makes sense for them, that we allow them to have the time to be planful and then go ahead and implement when they're ready. And similarly, giving them the flexibility to either implement those foundational capabilities and programs as a single county, so maybe maintaining their current structure, a county where they might share services, for example, an epidemiologist position that might be shared across three counties, where perhaps now there is no epidemiologist position that exists in that county. Or they might choose to form a health district, if that makes more sense for their geographic area, for their constituents. And then kind of overall, we would have some changes in governance for Oregon's public health system. We would take the existing public health advisory board and essentially task them with overseeing this process of implementing the foundational capabilities and programs, and that they would be setting outcome measures that the public health system needs to deliver on, because currently we aren't held to specific measures that everybody needs to be you know, delivering for the state of Oregon, so it really be moving us forward into a new generation. So essentially, I'll just kind of run through these quickly, but foundational capabilities that are found in the foundational framework are assessment and epidemiology, emergency preparedness and response, communications, policy and planning, leadership and organizational competencies, health equity and cultural responsiveness, and then community partnership development. So essentially, those would be the capabilities that staff that work in state and local health departments would have to possess in order to implement the foundational programs. So those programs are communicable disease control, environmental health, prevention and health promotion, and then access to clinical preventive services. And then, you know, you'll see in the graphic of the model that there's also a call out for additional programs, and just to clarify that those might be things that particular communities may need to have based on the circumstances where they live. So, for example, here in the metro area, there may be a need for a tuberculosis control program, whereas in other parts of the state, that may not be necessary. So, not to say that tuberculosis isn't important or that we shouldn't be addressing it, but it may be something specific to a certain part of our state versus others. Or, you know, there may be a need for particular efforts around smokeless tobacco in Eastern Oregon, and that may be less of an issue here in the metro area, for example.
So is it based on risk assessment?
Exactly. So each community, just like they have to do now, would have to do a community health improvement plan, and then, you know, some of those, some of that work would be folded into what these core programs and capabilities are, and then others might go beyond. So it would just depend on the circumstances in those individual communities and what other partners they might already have at the table who might be providing some of these services that are of public health benefit. So I'll just kind of skip through this. I think that the take-home point here is that there's very little state general fund going to public health. We rate 46th in the nation for state investment in public health per capita. And so part of this is designed to, again, really make sure that public health is well positioned to be where it needs to be in the future as a support for health system transformation and for population health generally. So then again, I mentioned this earlier, but the point here would be that local communities would be able to determine their own pathway for implementing the foundational capabilities and programs. They'd be able to do that in waves, so those that are ready and willing to go would be able to go ahead, and those that need a little more time to plan how they would organize themselves would have the flexibility to do that, and that they'd be able to do that either through a single county or by sharing either certain aspects of the foundational capabilities and programs with others or forming a health district. I think that that's really kind of the gist of what's going on. Currently, there's a House bill, House Bill 3100, and Senate Bill 663 are in the legislature. Both have hearings on March 9th, and you know, assuming that these bills do pass and become law, we'll be under kind of a quick timeline over the next biennium to really figure out how we implement these foundational capabilities and programs, so that in 2017 we'd be ready to start implementing by wave. So are there questions?
Yeah, I'm just curious if there's any requirement to have coordination with the local coordinated care organization, just because of our, the public health, you know, this being the HAI advisory committee, mm-hmm. close interaction with the public health and medical care.
So the task force had a lot of conversation about how relationships between public health, CCOs, education, and other partners really vary locally right now. In some cases, that's, you know, kind of hand in glove, and in other cases that work might still be forming. But that in that kind of assessment of how, to what extent are you meeting these foundational capabilities and programs, and how will you get there, that CCOs and other partners are very much at the table. And it may be that in certain communities, a particular foundational capability or program may, aspects of that actually may fall responsible to a CCO, because it may make more sense for that community. I think the task force really had in mind that what was important is that these are these foundational capabilities and programs are provided, and to be agnostic about who actually does that work.
Okay, any other questions?
What about checks and balances and compliance? I mean, how do you know, how will you monitor mm-hmm. how counties are doing and if they're at the standard you want it to be?
Right, and I also probably didn't make this clear enough, but the public health division itself would also be implementing these foundational capabilities and programs, and sort of in that process recognizing what's the state role in doing this work and what's the local role in making that very clear what those functions are. So one of the things that's new about this model is that the Public Health Advisory Board would be recommending metrics by which the public health system would need to perform, and there would likely be some kind of process by which great performance or being able to meet certain measures would be rewarded financially or otherwise. Those details are yet to be worked out, but this would be a brand new way of holding the public health system accountable for outcomes. and we'd be needing to report those on an annual basis.
That'd be interesting, like for STDs and that kind of thing as well. You'd set standards and see that you meet them.
That is the plan. We are really trying to kind of move our system forward, to move away from kind of individually counting the process that we do to being held accountable for outcomes.
And through public education and getting out there doing whatever.
Yeah, I think you know, some of those details will come in the next 2 years, but it's absolutely the intention of the task force to move us to outcomes.
So I'll take Dee Dee's role here. So what if I'm a consumer, what am I going to understand about this work? And what communication has there been to consumers?
So we're sort of just hitting the ground running with getting, getting word out about this opportunity in the future. Part of it is that there's a bill in the legislature right now, and so it's a matter of, you know, wanting to inform our stakeholders, but not wanting to get ahead of that process. So that, assuming the bill passes, you know, we can hit the ground running, but we haven't gone outside of our lane here. I think what's important for consumers to know is that currently in Oregon, because our public health system and the extent to which we provide public health services really varies based on where you live. It varies a lot with regard to county investment in public health. What's really important, and the task force talked a lot about, is that everyone in Oregon should expect a minimum public health service, regardless of where they live, and this would help us move there. Right now, it's really variable, and you can't expect the same service from one county to another based on the funding that goes along with that. Yeah.
I was just wondering if, I'm sorry, I showed up when you were about to slide and you may have said something about this, but did either the task force or do you guys have plans to assess some of these other states who clearly are getting more funding, or maybe they have a structure in place? You know, how does that help inform where we're headed, other best practices around the country that maybe you guys are learning from?
Yeah, so when the task force was meeting, we did bring in some national consultants that have done some work around cross-jurisdictional sharing, or basically sharing some of the work across county lines. We also heard several times from Washington State that it kind of undertaken this process before we did, and we adopted aspects of their work. They haven't implemented yet. They've kind of gotten to the place of figuring out how much this costs to deliver, and then they've kind of stopped there. So we do plan to kind of figure out what other states are doing, but Oregon is also a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of actually thinking about operationalizing this work.
So there's a bit of a pioneer thing going on here as well. And I know the CCO thing is somewhat unique here. Mm-hmm.
Our director was recently at a meeting with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and some other states that are taking a look at how to make this real. So we'll certainly stay plugged in and try to be a leader to
have that network.
Thanks.
One quick question. I was wondering if healthcare associated infections are at all mentioned in the bill?
Or is it just more general public health?
I would need to get the bill for you, but essentially the big report, if you're interested, the website is posted here, healthoregon.org/taskforce. Each of the program areas and capabilities have kind of a straw definition to them. And essentially what would need to happen after the bill, if the bill passes, is to better define exactly what those mean so that they're measurable, so we would know whether or not a particular health department is meeting that foundational program requirement or not. So I think more work on that is to come. And I'm sorry, I should have looked at this for you.
I'll take a look at the executive summary.
Yeah, and the report itself will have the fuller definition, and that's where the bill language really came from, almost verbatim.
Thank you. I had a quick comment. The comment is, I think this committee has been meeting for a while and sort of discussing metrics, and so when you finally get to the point of looking at outcomes, it would be really great if we could, you know, have some representation or collaborate with you on that.
Great.
And I'm glad you're here. And also just it's just sort of like a question about budget. So if the bill were to pass with this sort of kind of program, or the funds to increase foundational capacity, would that come from the general fund, or what sort of the
The elected officials that served on that task force sort of agreed that the conversation about funding needed to happen, and it needed to happen in the legislature. Because the bills have only had each had a public hearing once yet, I don't think that we've quite gotten into how we provide a glide path to making sure that these are robustly funded. Although that's a recommendation that's in here, and it's a recommendation that I think is heard pretty clearly. One of the things that would have to happen is once we define exactly what we mean by these programs and these capabilities is to figure out what it actually costs. And that's kind of where Washington State has ended up. They fully defined which we will definitely start with their definitions for the foundational capabilities and programs, because they kind of got down to real specific things. Then they figured out, okay, this means this many FTE, this means this kind of a database, this means this, and that's going to cost you this thing. So it's a little tough because we anticipate that piece of the work would happen in the 2017 session. So great questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, are we ready to move on to our next presentation? Diane will be giving us an update on HAI metrics for hospital transformation performance, starting on page 39 for those of you out there.
Do you mind if I quickly I just wanted to ask, I think someone else joined on the phone or some other people. Is that true? Okay, maybe not.
Well, Kate asked me to come share with you a little bit about the Hospital Transformation Performance Program, and in short, we call it HTPP, just because that's a mouthful. And the reason why that's important for this group to understand is that in the measure list for this program, there are two HAI measures that directly align with what hospitals already are reporting to the state and that you would be interested in knowing about. And so really what this program is all about, it's really a pay-for-performance or incentive program for hospitals, for specifically the DRG hospitals in the state, which there are 28 of. So out of the 62 hospital members that belong to the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, 28 of those are DRG hospitals, which means they participate in the hospital provider tax program. And so basically this program allows the Oregon Health Authority, through a deal with CMS, to make payments to hospitals that show performance improvement in a whole list of measures, which I'll share with you in just a minute. These measures were not pulled out of thin air. They were greatly discussed for a long time. As you can imagine, anytime measures are a topic of discussion, through a metrics advisory committee that was led by the Oregon Health Authority. And so really, at this point in time, we're smack in the middle of this program. This really began, we got approval actually way in the middle of the program, or the baseline year. So it's a two-year program that started October 1st of 2013, and the baseline program ran for 12 months, and now we're in the performance period, which started October 1st of 2014, and will run through September of this year. So the metrics committee that I referenced, has the authority through Oregon House Bill 2216 from the 2013 legislative session. And you can see there the composition of the metrics advisory committee. It was a well-balanced and well-rounded committee. There were about half the group that were from hospitals, who represented hospitals. We had some CCL representatives and three other individuals who had metrics expertise. And I mentioned this already, about the 28 hospitals that are eligible to participate. And so here's the list of measures which probably is of most interest to you. You can see there on the left-hand side two major focus areas, a hospital focus and a hospital CCO coordination focus. CMS was really interested and having this program think more broadly than just within the four walls of a hospital. So they wanted to know how hospitals were engaging with their community partners and community stakeholders. So that was the reason for the split in the focus area. So what you see here basically on the right-hand side is a list of the total, a list of 11 measures, and the top eight of those are focused around what happens in hospital operations, and the remaining there around the community pieces. So to be really honest, the most difficult ones to help hospitals with at this point in time have been those bottom three around the CCO coordination focus, around emergency department visit information, and around implementing ESPRT, which is screening, brief intervention, referral to treatment for drug and alcohol for folks who come through the emergency department. But, you know, this is a great thing for our state, because a year ago, we had none of this piece, and now we have made significant progress in this area. So as far as the HAI measures, you see up there, CLABSI and CAUTI and all tracked units. This was a carryover. I really pushed these two measures because hospitals that were involved with Partnership for Patients over the last 3 years have been tracking this, and it just seemed natural to continue this work because they were beginning to have momentum and to see some progress here and what was already being required through the state. So we're going for alignment wherever possible, right?
Yes, can I just ask you on that screen?
Yes.
On the two bottom, on 10 and 11,
uh-huh.
What is the follow-up after hospitalization? And then also, what is the brief intervention for the consumers on those?
Okay, so a little bit more about that. So Dee Dee, that question around follow-up after hospitalization for mental illness, that is a measure that is tracked by the Oregon Health Authority. So the hospitals aren't tracking that one, but OHA gets that information through claims data at the state. So they're really interested in knowing folks that have been recently discharged from a hospital for a mental health diagnosis, are they receiving the follow-up that they need to have? So that's an important one that's being tracked. And then number 11, the ESPRT measure. You may have heard that this has been initiated more so in primary care offices, especially in Oregon. At OHSU, Jim Winkle has been really instrumental in this work in helping primary care offices and clinics up there do this work. Now we're trying to integrate it and embed it in a hospital emergency department so that the measure is such that any patient who comes to the ED who's age 12 and older will have a brief screen. And there are three questions that they ask them, and I don't have it off the top of my head, but it's just to evaluate them on, gee, is drug and alcohol, is that going to be impactful for the reason that's bringing them here to the hospital? Or is there something else that we can do to assist them? And so if they screen positive, then the next piece of that is that they're eligible for a full screen, which is a longer screen with an approved tool, so that those folks that indicate that they have a need or an issue or a problem can be referred to resources that are available. So it's really trying to get more of a handle on a more holistic perspective of the patient when they come to the ED. So and very much needed, as you can imagine. Did that answer it?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So I mentioned to you that this money, I should probably explain a little bit how this comes. So hospitals agree to tax themselves through the hospital provider tax program at a certain amount, which helps fund the state Medicaid budget. And they agreed to increase that amount by 1% to have funds available for this incentive program. And so what that means is that they've got to demonstrate performance and improvement in that whole list of measures to be able to get those funds back returned to them. And if they don't do well, their piece of the funds would go to somebody else and has done so. And so there are two pieces here for the baseline year that I just talked about that is over with. If hospitals submitted data on 75% of that list of 11 measures, they got a floor allocation of money. And they really weren't looking at how did they do compared to anybody else or what was their improvement. So this next phase, the performance year, which we're in right now, is they're going to be paid according to how they performed. So this is a little bit more detail in case you're interested. How did they do against each measure? This step two, what is the measure worth, which I'll show you a breakdown on the next slide. And then in addition to what the measure is worth, they get rewarded on hospital size, so there's an adjustment factor depending on how many Medicaid patients that they have to make it a little more even. Here's the breakdown, probably more detail than you wanted to know, but we just try to simplify as much as possible so that you see the breakdown there.
And this is readmission within 30 days?
Yes, yes, all cause readmissions. So here's that adjustment factor that I spoke about based on Medicaid discharges and Medicaid inpatient days, and then the calculation based on the discharge date and the time frame there for when that was calculated. So this has been a big partnership between the Hospital Association, EPRISE is our data subsidiary, and then of course the Oregon Health Authority. This slide just kind of outlines what our role in this has been. We've been really key in helping with, we set up a reporting platform for hospitals. We are making sure that the data gets submitted to us timely. We're looking at for validity. We get it to the Oregon Health Authority so that they can review it and make sure everything is in line before it gets submitted to CMS. Oregon Health Authority, they're the ones that track this after hospitalization for mental illness measure. They're looking at the data to see if it meets the thresholds, if things are correct. They're going to perform the payment calculations, and they're the ones that distribute the payments. So where we are right now, hospitals, as I mentioned, they just had their baseline data submitted. They had it reviewed by the state. The hospitals got to see their data back to them just to say, here we are, Oregon Health Authority, this is what we've seen from you, is this correct? And then based on that, Oregon Health Authority will notify them about what their payments are going to be, which they'll be distributed on April 30th. So there's a lot more information on the Oregon Health Authority website. Here is the link. If you want to see all the measure specifications and all the backdrop to this program. So I know I raced through that, but any questions about what it is or how it's being implemented or why?
Yeah, I was just curious on how and why you decided to use CLABSI in county and what other options you might have had from HAIs.
Well, that's a really good question. At the time, there's a lot of work that's been done around CLABSI in the state. So folks have done really well with that in the ICU, but not particularly all track units. And then CAUTI is, you know, a horse of another color. That's a tough one, you know, tough nut, not just for our state, but every state across the nation. And so, yeah, you know, it's kind of like a balance. You know, one, we have a fighting chance of doing well and looking pretty good, and the other one, we still have a lot of work to do. So, you know, because those were being tracked and they seem to be of importance to the state, there could have been a whole list of other ones we could have
chosen. Oh, yeah, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Are there validations being planned to review to make sure that people are reporting appropriately?
So this data is all from NHSN. So at this point in time, no, we're not planning validations. Yeah, on this. So important data. So yeah.
It'd be great to do that if we.
Yeah,
we've seen that it's extremely important.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so for sure. For sure.
But I mean, it's obvious that there's now enormous incentive.
Yes.
To lowball your count.
Yeah, exactly.
I can see the pressure. Yeah. You know, three UTIs this month. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean the issue of hospitals being penalized that are doing a better job of actually reporting and surveillance and whatnot is concerning. And that's, I don't have a great answer for that, but I think that ideally you'd validate all data and that at least would get to accurate initial data.
Can I ask, what do you think, Diane, would be the most difficult of these, all these measures to reach? I mean, can you kind of predict based on what they are and what you know about hospitals that, you know, these particular ones are going to be difficult to pull up?
Well, the medication safety measures have been tough. I started my group of hospitals that worked with me on Partnership for Patients on these three measures last year. So I feel like some of them have a little bit of a head start because, believe it or not, some hospitals weren't tracking these three on a regular basis. And so it's like, why not, right? So those are probably not as tough, but the ones that seem to be the toughest, like number 11, the ESPRT. So there's a lot of confusion on, how do I track this? It really isn't so much about doing the screening, it's how do I implement this workflow into my existing emergency department? Who's gonna do it? Who's responsible? How do we record it? How do we track it? It's, just that learning curve. So if you know about ESPRT, we're only looking at like the first two components of ESPRT, and there's like, other ones that come behind. So there's a thought that this program will continue. It's in front of the legislature now. If it continues for the next 2 years, it is reasonable to think that this measure list will change somewhat. ESPRT probably will be expanded, and it may be that the focus around CCO community measures would be 50%, and if hospital focused 50%, it would be more. It would be so, just a natural outgrowth there. But I think that anything that's been CCO related or something new like ESPRT, that's really the biggest learning curve.
I have one question on measure three. What would be excessive?
So there's a benchmark now of 5%. So anything over 5%. I mean, really what you want to shoot for is zero. You don't want anybody to have excessive anticoagulation or an adverse drug event. But where we're starting them right now is, first of all, monitor your data, and can you consistently perform below 5%? And then if that measure continues, that would be ratcheted down.
Although there are different patients sometimes have different target levels based on what their history is. Is it possible to take all that into account when you're looking at excessive?
Well, the measure is worded such that it's, the first dose of warfarin that you give in the hospital. So a lot of patients come to the ED with an elevated INR already, so you're not going to be dinged for that one. But, what happens on your watch here? Then there's also been a question about what if they're on a gatroban as well, right? That sometimes causes it to be falsely inflated. So the measure specs kind of take all of that into account. So, it's not rocket science, it's not perfect by any means, but doing the best we can here with this measure.
So it's not like they have a bleed or some adverse event, just that the number, the level's too high or out of range.
Yes. Gotcha. Okay. Right.
They don't have to have that.
So within your normal adverse, yeah.
And you're only looking at warfarin and not any of the other anticoagulants that are commonly used in hospitals?
Yep, warfarin is the only time. Yep, starting summer.
Clarify for the cardiac biopsy. To meet your target at the hospital, is it a relative measure? So do you have to just decrease from one year to the next rather than being absolute? Just because I noticed if it's rate, there's no risk adjustment here.
Right. So there is, based on all of the data for the baseline year, benchmarks were being established, right? And so you have to either meet the benchmark or have a 10% improvement from your own rate.
From your own, so the benchmark rate is for all hospitals combined.
Yeah. Okay.
So the better you are, the harder it is to maintain.
Yes. Yes.
Especially if you're zero, which is
yeah.
A lot of hospitals.
Do you have any, I think you alluded to the possibility that you might potentially reevaluate or change things. Is that, so is there, what's the process for that?
So right now, there's a call out from the Oregon Health Authority for members for this committee. And that you either need to be a hospital rep or be a metrics expert, right, or from a CCO, so that, you know, the floor is open for you to participate here. So that group's going to be convened again this spring to be looking at, well, what does phase two of this program look like?
And how long is this program going on? It says 2 years, and then it says that.
Right. So we're in the middle of the second year right now, and the next phase of this would begin this fall, if everything puts along time again.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Question. I'm intrigued to hear about the funding methods that are used. How is that working? The metrics will change, but how hospitals, you know, function, is that going to be an efficient way to incentivize them to essentially their own money?
Right. This is totally brand new. This is totally brand new. They've never had this before. And so they're
hundreds of thousands of dollars at least.
It's
big money.
It's a chunk of change.
So they're taxing themselves into a pool of money, and then if they do well, they get a portion back.
Yep.
And has that, I mean, from the hospital point of view, has that been a successful model?
Yeah, the hospital provider tax. And then this extra 1% is, you know, out there, for which they may get some back or they may not get any back, depending on how they do. Any other questions?
Okay, thanks, Diane. Okay, coming up next on the agenda, we have Kate Ellingson, who will present the HAI annual report, proposed new formats for consumers and providers, and facility-specific report cards.
Everybody's favorite.
Yes.
Been
holding
our breath for a year. I know. So we're basically just gonna have a break in about 15-20 minutes. So you know, bear with me through this, and this actually is meant to be fairly interactive. I'm trying to get some feedback based on you know, how we've integrated your feedback from the last session and kind of what our plans are going forward. Basically, now I just want to talk a little bit about the timeline, the report format. We received some feedback at the last meeting about the desire to sort of have two ways of viewing this data, from the consumer perspective and from the provider perspective. And we discussed some data displays, and I had some additional follow-up questions for you all about that. We've also been talking on our team about this concept of facility-specific report cards. So these reports are basically going to have data listed by facility. And in previous years, there's sort of been an appendix where each facility is listed individually with, you know, all 12 of their metrics. And that's something we didn't do last year. And I think something that might be useful for facilities, instead of having to go look for themselves on page 2A17 of the report to have everything in one place. We're also thinking about that. I showed this slide last time. This is just to kind of like reorient with where we are for hospitals. These are all of the metrics that have been proposed since 2009, and you can kind of see how they've been reported. And so for the 2014 report, we have 12 metrics for hospitals. And so I just mentioned this to you as kind of to plant the seed as we're moving forward. One of, you know, last year's report was very comprehensive. I think everybody liked the various data displays. The only complaint we had was that it was over 100 pages and kind of unwieldy. So given that we've got to get 12 metrics reported, it's sort of, we're trying to think creatively about how best to display that information in a kind of less overwhelming way. You know, still for non-hospitals, mostly it's influenza, healthcare worker influenza vaccination. Is the only required reporting metric for long-term care facilities and ASCs, and our dialysis facilities do some dialysis event reporting, which these events are meant to sort of to approximate bloodstream infections in dialysis patients. So publication schedule, last year's report came out in summer of 2014, and so our target this year is to get the report out by July 31st, 2015. And this just sort of aligns also with some of our funding. The funding we received to do this report has this deadline. It might seem like a long time,
But this actually is faster than the CDC reports out data, and most states actually have more of a lag in reporting out their data. And this is mainly because hospitals have some time before they have to get it into our NHSN reporting system, CMS deadlines, et cetera. So we're trying to align ourselves with when CMS requires hospitals to report data, and then try to get it out in a timely fashion. I don't know if everybody can, this is actually a pretty bad slide because nobody can see it, but I guess all this to say is sort of on the top, this is like going January through April, is there just a, we're trying to actually focus our work on getting the report format right, figuring out what we want it to look like, how long we want it to be, whether we want one or two reports, and we're moving forward on that. And then the other piece on the bottom is really getting the data from all these facilities, which is a pretty a big effort. And just to kind of let you know where we are now, we're downloading the data from NHSN and sending preliminary reports out to the hospitals so that they will have between early April and mid-May to just check their numbers. Because in mid-May, CMS basically freezes the data, and that's what goes up on hospital care. So we actually want to work with the data, with the facilities for that time. One, so we can help them with the quality of their data, but also make sure that what we have in our report isn't different from what CMS ends up posting, which has happened in years past, and it's always a little bit awkward. And so you can see, like, for the second half, from April to July, basically, we're just going to be focusing on data and data quality and following up with facilities. As Monica actually helped write some a standard operating procedure for following up with our long-term care facilities and ASCs in terms of getting their influenza vaccination data in. They actually can be fined, and we've never invoked this before, but it ends up being quite an effort on Monica's part to follow up. So we're going to try to be, to be very clear about, you know, when it's due, and try out the standard operating procedure this year. So
when is it due?
It's actually, so May 15th so CMS has all these different quality reporting programs, so facilities get reimbursed for just reporting to NHSN, and they have to have their data in for the fourth quarter of 2014, which is the end of our kind of reporting period. It has to be in by May 15th for all of the hospital metrics, and also influenza vaccination data for 14-15 from all of these facilities.
I literally just checked my email. I got back here at 12:30. There is an email that was blasted out by CMS that long-term care facilities, or no, ambulatory surgical centers, don't have to have their data at Lubex data now by until August.
Oh, okay, well, just hot off the press.
So that's going to be a part of us.
Okay.
We haven't even talked about that. I literally just read it.
Okay.
Sorry.
But I should note, in the past, Monica has had to contact facilities like as many as 10 times over a period of months to try to get the permission that they're required.
Yeah, so now the standard operating procedure says that we won't potentially fund facilities because we could. We prefer not to do that.
Threatening work.
Hopefully you don't have to do
that. It didn't work. I just tried it. So now we can actually do it and see if that works.
Well, I mean, this may have implications. We were sort of excited that the May 15th deadline appeared to be consistent because we could get everything into one report. But, you know, last year the flu vaccination report came out in the fall instead of coming out in the summer. And we may have to revert to that this year, but so just to kind of, at the December meeting, sort of recap what this committee recommended. Basically, everyone agreed that we needed some kind of clear summary presentation for consumers, and that, you know, the 100-page report, which was really rich in information and data, you know, maybe wasn't the easiest for consumers to read. And so we talked about, having kind of, a very simple level of data presentation for consumers and a more detailed and complex level for the providers. And so that's the direction we're moving this year. But keeping in mind that everybody will have access to that kind of more granular data. So if the more savvy consumer wants to get into what the confidence intervals are, what the SIRs are, they can go there. A couple of things that also came up in December was that a few of our members wanted us to display rates in addition to SIRs, which actually is not a problem. In our previous reports, we report the observed infections and the denominators. We just we focus most on SIRs, but we can put rates in as well. I mean, the reason we moved towards the standardized infection ratios is because they're risk adjusted, but nothing precludes anyone reading the report from calculating a rate, so we can certainly include that. Also, there was some people were asking, I know Mary in particular was talking about how it would be nice to be able to compare your hospital to peer hospitals. And so one of the things we've thought about is just doing a very simple stratification by hospital size. So when you know you look at your data, you could also look at, you know, what does a similarly sized hospital look like in terms of their SIRs and rates for the various metrics. And we also talked about some color coding of confidence intervals. I'll ask you for some feedback in a minute on that. The other thing that came up is sort of this need for like a tight executive summary so that we could just, you know, you had your sort of SOCO or single overriding communication message about how Oregon was doing, where it was weak, where it appears to be strong. And so we're really going to work to get that together too. So based on the recommendations, as I mentioned, we're going to have two reports and try to do an executive summary that is graphic in a good way, graphic with an overall picture of Oregon. So like, I'll show you an example in a minute, but we're going to work with our design and publications crew to come up with something that would sort of be a two-pager front and back where you can see all the infections and their rates. So, but before we get to the executive summary, I just wanted to share with you some findings from a CDC subcommittee that is really dedicated to people at the state level who are putting out these reports. Most of the states in the country are doing annual reports just as we are, and a lot of people are struggling with, you know, the complexity of the information relative to, you know, the audience that's seeking this information, the public. And so there was a subgroup that actually went and did some pilot testing and focus groups with consumers to see how they would want to see the data. So they had various kind of experimental groups, you know, some where people were shown, you know, here's an SIR and a confidence interval and a rate, you know, here's no confidence intervals and all these different permutations. And what's displayed up here was sort of the most well-received on the consumer level. And so we'll just sort of walk by. And one thing to first to notice is, so think of the table at the top is the legend, and then on the bottom is sort of how it might look to have sort of facilities listed out. And you'll notice that there's no SIR here at all, although there's sort of a qualitative assessment based on the SIR in the right-hand column. So if you look at the first facility, this is like an example for CLABSI reporting, clean hospital, and you know, we don't actually report out wards yet, but for states that are reporting wards, you can split ICUs and wards. So you can see the number of infections in that calendar year, and then the number of predicted infections. And there's a very kind of, we've talked about very simple ways of explaining how the predicted infections are generated. And then an assessment of whether this is significantly better than what we would expect based on the national experience, significantly worse, or the same, or no conclusion. And I think that came from just what people were hearing from the consumer groups was, I don't necessarily want all the data, but tell me which hospital is better. And so we're looking into this. And I'll just show you another. One of the issues that has come up is that in Oregon, we have a lot of, you know, there's some smaller hospitals that don't necessarily have enough denominator days to actually achieve statistical significance in either a positive or a negative way. So a lot of our hospitals will have, if we were to use this report, would have this gray sort of same, you know, qualitative assessment. And the question is that useful? Do we sort of, by kind of making it so simple, do we sort of lose some of the, you know, subtle information?
It would be less than one anyway.
Yeah, I mean, and you could, yeah, I guess they could see that the SIR is less. You could do that calculation, but one thing that some of the other states that are dealing with this issue as well, Hawaii is one that they have so many small hospitals that nobody can reach statistical significance. And so they really, they've started sort of emphasizing this zero infection. So for hospitals that have zero infections, they don't get kind of a green star or a red X, but they get like a hibiscus flower next to their name. You know, so it's like there's something positive that they take away just because they've had zero infections. You could make the argument that that's not really fair. If you had a big hospital that had one infection, but they expected 30, then maybe they should get a hibiscus flower. But there's no perfect solution here. It's kind of something that
And then, so this is, I'm kind of overlaying this. This is kind of how we had sort of this kind of color coding system in last year's report for SIR. So sort of the dark green if SIR is significantly less than one, a light green if it's less than one but not significant, a light pink if it's more than one but not significant, and then this sort of dark red if it achieves statistical significance. So I guess my question for you, for the group, is, you know, A, kind of how you feel about this type of different format for consumers, and whether you think we need to do something to provide information on the hospitals that are not statistically different from the national average, so they would appear like with this scheme to be the same.
Well, we did struggle with how to identify that.
Yeah, we've gone. I mean, those of us that have been here for a long time, we've gone around with various possibilities.
But I do like the CDC work group identifying it. It's more clear than what we have with the arrow up, arrow down, and the shades.
All right, now, are you concerned about the issue that she was kind of bringing up? You're going to have a lot of hospitals then that just say the same.
Yeah.
And so I know in the past we've had some people that have been concerned about that and said, well, this place, yeah, they might not be statistically significantly worse, but they do have a number that's above the national average, and I'd like to know that. Now, I don't know. Right now, maybe everyone's fine with it like this. I kind of am fine with whatever everyone else wants to do. You know, so.
It's a shot in the dark, but I'll ask the question anyway. Is there any chance the health authority has any sort of patient advisory group where this could be? In a little context loaded by them so that they could respond. I mean, it strikes me that we're asking the question and all of us are inside the industry,
right,
and very tainted because of that. And I know that at the commission we struggle with this a lot as well. It's like, what are they really seeing when we put this out, right?
Yeah.
So I just wondered if there was any sort of patient advisor group at the health authority that could just be leveraged to ask. I understand that it's probably a no, but I figured I'd ask you.
Great question. I don't know.
I have to say, I'm not, now Paul or Dana or anyone else aware of something like that? I am not aware of that.
You
I think it's a great idea.
Next session.
Yeah. The fear of bringing it up is that, oh gosh, you know, and I realize that there's always a limit to, but I do think that's one of the things that we struggle with is, they're hard to put together, but if there was any chance there was one in place.
I think it's great. I'd love to. I've been wanting to have more interaction with patients trying to figure out how to do it. I'm not sure how to do it.
Topic. I mean, we will continue to because we're all very jaded with what we operate under.
Right, but if you have it in place for 2 or 3 years, then they become lost also, and they can't, you know, so that's in that way. And what you could do is a lot of our standing committees do have public members. You could take a public member for drinking water. That would be a good person. They're pretty fresh. They don't, you know,
I mean,
drinking water.
Maybe along with a couple of the other,
that's a great idea.
So if
I
you
mean,
took him and met Pat and Jerry a couple times a year, and you took all your public members and said, yeah, come to this extra public, because each one of us, a lot of us have advisory committees where we have a public member. There's one that's there. We have a couple, and maybe get those people together, and you could leverage, you know, an extra meeting to do like a list of things. Yeah.
And CEOs all have to have a member of the board too, which might be an interesting.
Oh, I hadn't thought about pulling from their board. That's a great idea.
Yeah,
that's a good idea too. Yeah, because I mean, it just needs a little framing, and then you can just say, you know, what strikes you, what's working for you, what's not.
Yeah.
And most of the hospitals have patient advisory committees as well, and you could take representatives from each of those even and put together a super advisory committee, you know.
Usually if it's a one-time thing like that, people are pretty happy to give you an hour at a time.
Mm-hmm. You know, offer food and a nice meal.
Yeah. Coordinating it is the hardest part, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great suggestion.
I mean, I like that idea of actually just approaching hospitals and asking if each one could volunteer or someone for each of these advisory committees.
They already have those committees in place.
I mean, yeah, we're reaching out to them now to send them their preliminary data, so this can be part of it as we send out the email. You know, this is an opportunity to have some input on the new format.
Just as another random possibility, SurveyMonkey also has the option of you can buy responses to some of your responses, and that really would be like Joe Community or Joe Community.
Yeah,
and you can send out your thing and ask for, I don't know what the cost or anything behind that is, but you can just sort of have
Yeah, you won't answer.
Yeah. We have to have a pretty big end of people to send it to get some kind of response rating we felt good about, but it's still an idea.
Do we solicit stuff on the website? Comments?
Do we have a place now? That's a great idea also. We should do that.
What do you think?
I like that idea.
We'll
really find out. Yeah, maybe it's one of those things.
You have an email, but yeah, we can make it more for.
Yeah, it might be good for us to.
Right next to the report.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it'd be totally impressive to have two or three of them vehicles like that, and then just kind of culminate once you get back.
Yeah.
If no one responds to the website, we'll find, maybe they will.
I mean, those are the people who are looking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So I don't know if you had more slides or, because I was going to.
This is kind of what it looked like with the different kinds of, so here's an example. I just wanted to show where there's a hospital that was statistically below the national experience.
And just one piece I was noticing with this is, Mrs. Jen, that because you give the absolute numbers, that does put this, even if it all says same, there is some sort of context, I think, with using concrete numbers that can help.
Well, especially with surgeries, I think the number of procedures that a hospital performs is sort of important. And I think it gets lost in some of our reports with lots and lots of numbers.
It's already captured, it gets lost, but if you're like that,
I'm
wondering if. Show the raw numbers.
So I was going to say, I was wondering if instead of using the term events, saying observed infections, or I'm just thinking of trying to put myself in the mind of someone who's just looking at this that isn't used to thinking about this stuff at all, like to know that that's a.
And I will say actually we have publications group that's gonna help work with us on getting they're gonna read it over to try to get it so that it's consumer friendly because they look at a lot of these reports. So as long as we can get it done in time, we'll be able to. So just quickly, kind of what we're thinking in terms of the technical report for providers, so beyond the consumer report, this would have basically all of this data here is data that was in last year's report. At the bottom, I think there's a percent change from 14 to 13 SIR. I think that's something people are interested in. And last year's report had a lot of trends. But again, for CLASI alone, there were still 6 pages worth of data because it was kind of a separate page for each different thing. And so I'm experimenting with some formats. This isn't pretty, but trying to figure out how to get as much information as possible on one line. It may seem kind of busy, but I think having it all in one place instead of having to flip pages might sort of help us. Right now I'm kind of exporting data and trying to figure out the best ways to display it. But, where we are with the technical report.
So are you saying you provide this to all hospitals and then they tell them what their key is or something like that? I'm a big concern about that. They might be able to identify.
For sending out the preliminary report, that's just going to be numbers for them to check. This is just to get your feedback on what it might look like at the end of the final report. Yeah. And then in terms of the graphic executive summary, this is something I think I showed you at the last meeting. Actually, this report by the CDC was published in January of this year. Basically, each state was given sort of an overall summary. And this actually graphic was also pilot tested with a bunch of consumer groups. And they sort of, this is kind of the result of these pilot tests. So we're trying to work on something organ specific that has more, we have a few more SSIs to report. And that's maybe less wordy, but having this kind of summary report, both the consumer and the provider report, so we're working with our design people on that. We've talked a little bit about, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go into detail about this, but we've talked a little bit about facility report cards, and that might be something at the next meeting when, I'm showing you that we're going to have the report pretty much done, and facility report cards are kind of the next step, I feel like, getting their data in a way that's helpful and useful.
Can I just clarify for the report that's out there for consumers or for anybody going online, would there be rates published by facility?
There would,
numerator, denominator, kind of stuff?
There would actually, we could add that, but the kind of the format I showed there actually did not have rates, but the consumer would have access, they still would have access to
the report. Because currently what they're getting, I, not really thinking that publishing rates is all that good, because rates, like you say, are not stratified.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that come off of that before mm-hmm. you see the SIR.
Yeah.
So I think rates are for C. diff, for me personally as a hospital person, I would really like to know C. diff rates, because those are something that seem to be hard to control.
Mm-hmm.
You're setting your goals every year and it's going up.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I would be very interested in other hospitals' rates, not the SIR.
Yeah.
Just to see, so when I'm goal setting, what would be realistic? Am I setting my goals too low
mm-hmm.
and therefore I'm not hitting my target? So what's going on in terms of C. diff rates in hospitals in the state of Oregon? I'd love to know that. And I don't need to know the hospital name, but I would love to know the bed size category.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, definitely we can provide that. And I mean, we should, for each hospital, we should be able to see, I mean, we could do a rate for, this is, I think, for 10,000 patient days. This
right.
is actually a C. diff example right here.
Right.
So we would have it by hospital, but then, yeah, the additional stratification by hospital size would allow you to kind of look at
it. So I would say that those rates are pretty good.
This is kind of, yeah.
Those are low rates.
This isn't real data from
okay.
the state of Oregon. That's from another state.
Yeah, but I don't know the consumers, and I don't know the hospitals are ready to have people compare rates for different procedures, for example, surgical, because there's a lot to be taken in. Who's doing high-risk procedures? You know, people, especially when you're looking at open heart and things like that, there's a lot of things that go into that that are not reflected in the rates. Plus, some are superficial and some are deep and some are organ space. So they're not looking at that. It's just a total allocation of the number. So
am I hearing that for maybe for surgical site infections, you would not want a rate published?
No,
but
I think that would be fair.
As if it would be okay because it's a facility-wide kind of surveillance.
That's what I'll ask.
I don't have any thoughts about that.
Anybody?
No, that's a good comment because it's sort of like...
Diane, do you have any feelings one way or the other?
I haven't heard from hospitals one way or the other.
No, and I'm just thinking, I have not talked to all my colleagues at APIC, but that might be something to put out there at the next APIC meeting.
Okay.
To see,
yeah.
You know, what the feeling would be. But I think people would be okay with unlabeled identification of C. diff rates. But I think surgical site infection rates published by facility, that would make people very uncomfortable because of the reasons mentioned.
Okay. All right, well, I think in the interest of time, we're going to just move to take a...
Okay, we'd like to get started. And coming up next from Monica is the OAR update.
Yes, thank you. I will be brief since we're running behind. If you remember from our January meeting, I'm sorry I didn't bring materials, so I didn't want to inundate you with more boring Oregon administrative rules. But in January, I had brought up the fact that we were going to align our Oregon administrative rules with CMS, which included the dropping of skip measures when CMS dropped them, and also the addition of inpatient psychiatric facilities and dialysis facilities to the healthcare worker influenza vaccination survey starting in the fall of 2015. So to be proactive, we thought we were doing, we were going to change these rules in advance for once. And then Dana brought up the fact at the last meeting.
she's such a
buzzkill. That's not a thing.
Yeah. That we don't necessarily have that designation in Oregon for inpatient psychiatric facilities. So after spending a very patient hour, Dana helped us with Melanie determine that we do have inpatient psychiatric facilities in Oregon, but they fall under our definition of acute care hospital. So I took that word inpatient psychiatric facilities out of the new administrative rules, left in just the change, the addition of dialysis facilities this coming fall. But then at our public hearing, we had nobody show up for comment, but we did receive a letter after the fact from Fresenius, a very large dialysis corporation, not based in Oregon, but have several facilities in Oregon, that they, you know, we included in our statement of need and fiscal impact, which you have to do for every administrative rule change, that we were going to be in line with CMS, there would be no additional financial burden, forgetting the fact that we have Oregon-specific questions regarding how people promoted their flu vax survey, how we promoted
strategies,
yeah, and several, we had three or four Oregon only questions, and Fresenius said, well, wait a minute, that is more than what CMS required. So we went back to the drawing table at an internal HAI meeting, discussed the fact that we've collected this data for the last 3 to 4 years, which Kate's going to talk about next. We've got some great information from it already. Why don't we just go ahead and drop these Oregon questions? So we did that. So now, everybody's going to be reporting through NHSN, except for long-term care facilities whom we encourage to use NHSN. They just don't necessarily use it right now. And those are the only changes we had to make from our rules from our last meeting update in January. Does anybody have any questions about that? No? Okay, good. I told you I'd be quick. Thank you.
Okay, I will be quick too, before we get on to this discussion of the whole supplement funding. So this, for you guys on the phone, you have a handout on page 69 of your meeting materials. And this is basically, I summarized kind of in this the first part of this paragraph, just what Monica said. So that basically, we have been collecting information from long-term care facilities, ASCs, and hospitals about what promotion strategies they use, et cetera, which is above and beyond what CMS asks these facilities to report for reimbursement, like we talked about before. And so if you kind of, I'm going to just scroll down on this document here. So what are the NHSN elements that everyone is currently reporting? And these right here, it's basically the number of, you know, employees, licensed independent practitioners, students, volunteers, and other personnel, the number vaccinated, number with a medical contraindication, number who declined vaccine, and number with unknown vaccination status. So it's very bare bones, give us the information we need to calculate a vaccination rate for your facility. And so that's what, you know, facilities across the nation are reporting and what CMS is reimbursing for at this point. So if you scroll down to the bottom of the page, you'll see actually the Oregon specific elements, which are, you know, arguably more interesting, but also not part of this national reporting program, not part of NHSN. So facilities who report these have to go into NHSN, record their data, and then fill out a separate SurveyMonkey survey. That's what they've been doing. And so, and we kind of realized we've been reporting out these measures every year, but we haven't necessarily done a lot of analysis with them. So we just kind of wanted to draw your attention to these elements and let you know that they are not going to be asked as part of our Oregon reporting program from here on out. It doesn't mean that they can't be asked as part of other surveys. And so that's kind of one of the things. We just wanted to draw your attention to these questions, you know, have you think about them a bit, and maybe, you know, get some of your thoughts about whether we should be asking these through different forms. For example, there's a mandatory survey that all long-term care facilities have to fill out every year. We could ask some of these questions on that survey. So Oregon-specific elements, you know, which the following methods did you use to deliver vaccine? So these are listed here. Promotional strategies, kind of incentives for individuals to get vaccinated. And then we also ask the questions about the reasons for declination. And so one of the things when we were talking about getting rid of these questions, we thought, well, what do we actually do with these questions? And we realized we hadn't actually looked at whether or not vaccination rates differ depending on whether facilities use these different strategies. So we did sort of a quick and dirty analysis, and we'd like to do a more involved analysis, but I just wanted to provide this data to you guys, the committee, because it actually was requested by one of our members after the last meeting. And so I'll just kind of take you through this table one on the second page of the handout. So basically, in the left-hand column, you have all of the vaccine delivery methods or strategies. And so if we move across kind of the first row, no-cost vaccine, the first kind of big column is hospitals. We had 61 hospitals reporting on this. And out of those hospitals, 90% used this strategy, provided no-cost vaccine. So out of those, you know, the 90% that used this strategy, they had a 76% vaccination rate. And for the 10% that didn't use it, they had a 79% vaccination rate. So it's kind of like, it didn't really appear to change. Not sure what's going on. But if you look at the, in the next column at ASCs, we see that, you know, 85% provide no-cost vaccine. And actually,
for the ASCs that provide no-cost vaccine, they have significantly higher vaccination rates than ASCs that do not provide no-cost vaccine. And so this is kind of how this analysis went. We just sort of went through each of the different strategies and just kind of wanted to point out for hospitals, most of the hospitals are adopting most of these strategies. The one that they're not sort of, you know, one that they're not really doing much with credentialing, but also only a third of them say this vaccinate or wear mask. Basically, it means if you don't get a vaccination, you have to wear a mask when treating patients during influenza season. So only 31% of hospitals are doing this, but it appears to be a significant predictor of getting your vaccination rates nudged above the average. So, yeah.
And what do they do for incentives? What are some examples of incentives?
That's a really good question. That's all it says is incentives.
Oh, it's just you gave us like a $5 use at any one of the beverage carts throughout the hospital, just little tiny things like that. It's, I think,
yeah, if you get like a pump card or Jamba Juice, that kind of thing.
So yeah, I mean, like the bottom line, I would say like that you know the different strategies appear to be you know effective, kind of variably effective depending on what kind of setting you're in. And so you know we're going to try to summarize some of this information. And if we do a facility specific report card, we'll put their vaccination rate. And then let's say if it is an ASC, we can say these are the factors that appear to be associated with improving vaccination rate.
Definitely looking at the wearing mask, and I know several hospitals, for hospitals it appears to be highly significant in improving rates, but there is a pushback.
I've heard from unions and
well, because it's disclosing protected healthcare information. I mean, you're wearing a badge that says I didn't get my flu vaccine by wearing a mask during flu season.
But you're also protecting your patients.
Sure, but it's your decision on whether or not to vaccinate, and that shouldn't be something that is public knowledge.
I think herein is the debate about whether Okay, well this really, you know, if you guys have any other questions or comments, we can talk afterwards. You can email me. Just wanted you to have this information to let you know we're using this data and that we might, one option is to potentially, you know, not collect this information every year, but if we have a survey that goes out every few years, we can kind of recollect it and see where we are at another point in time.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so next on the agenda, we have Vince, who will present new Ebola funding from CDC to extend HAI.
I think Jen volunteered. I started putting together slides yesterday and walked over, and Jen was already doing it. So
all right, then.
Well, thank you. So again, for those on the phone, my name is Genevieve Buster, and I work at ACDP with the HAI team, and wanted to tell you about hopefully an exciting funding opportunity. We're still waiting to hear about this, but since the deadline is soon, we wanted to share a little bit about our Ebola grant that we applied for, along with all the states across the U.S. So just to put this into context, so because of the huge response that was needed across the nation, to bring the healthcare system up to speed to be able to handle something like Ebola, just enormous amount of resources and time and learning occurred, as I'm sure you're familiar with. And so in response to that, CDC and its partners put out several grants in order to assist states with continuing to build these resources. And so there are several grants named here in the different blue boxes on the screen. And they go to different partners with the HPP now is part of the preparedness as well as the PHEP, the preparedness. And maybe Akiko, could you remind me, and since we're not familiar with those acronyms,
Public Health Emergency Preparedness, that goes out to all of our local public health authorities that do preparedness work as well as to our 95. And then the BAPHEP is the Hospital for Healthcare Preparedness Program, and that goes out to our coalition. Our healthcare coalitions in each of the regions, and they're made up of hospitals, acute care facilities, EMS folks, and also the public health authorities.
So I should have mentioned that both Akiko and Mike are with us today from Preparedness and Emergency Response. Because this grant was grants have been given to both of our departments,
And that comes out of just the experience of working on the Ebola response. It really was, within an agency, many different parts, not just the hospitals, but emergency transport, waste management. So the part that I will focus on today is what's in the Red Star, which is the grant. It's the Epidemiology and Laboratory Capacity Grant, or ELC grant. But it's part of a larger group of grants that we hope to receive funding for to work not only Ebola, but you'll see in other things. So the funding for the epidemiology and laboratory capacity is separate from the preparedness parts of the Ebola funding. And our part has a two-part focus, and it's, as other ELC grants, our focus on building statewide capacity and education, not only the state, but in the local regions. And the main part of this that we've talked to a lot about is these consultative and non-regulatory verifications or assessments of those hospitals who were so great to stand up and volunteer their services to be assessment hospitals. And assessment hospitals are the hospitals that will, if we have a person who is at risk of developing Ebola disease, become symptomatic with fever, other symptoms, these hospitals said we are ready to receive them and take care of them until we can confirm or rule out the diagnosis. So we have 7 of those with in different regions across Oregon. So the first part of the grant would be to go in and have these consultative verifications to see are they meeting the domains that CDC has put forward as being necessary, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later. And that would mostly be done in year one. The part that's really interesting for all hospitals across Oregon are this, the other part, which has to do with developing the statewide infection control capacity to prevent healthcare-associated infections and other emerging pathogen infections in the future. And so this is the part I think we should all be jazzed about, because we're not just focusing on Ebola, but general capacity building around our favorite topic. Thirdly, there's also a piece to improve biosafety capacity at the public health laboratory. So many partnerships are involved with this or will be involved in this, including healthcare facilities across the state from large to small, the state laboratory. This HAI advisory committee, which I will talk a little bit more about, will actually have a particular role in it. Because we hope to house what's called the Infection Control and Assessment Program. And it's basically the subcommittee that will help organize the ELC activities as part of this grant if we get that. Of course, the Patient Safety Commission, who we've partnered with a lot over the years, APIC, CDC, and also our preparedness and EMS folks, which are a key component. A little bit more about how this committee here would be involved with the grant. So as I mentioned, the grant asks that each state develop what's called an infection control and assessment promotion program group. And they are usually going to be housed within the HAI existing advisory committees, not necessarily, but that's usually where it's recommended to be placed, since these are groups that have a history of working with healthcare. And that this would take this committee, which has historically been surveillance only, and start thinking about ways we can use the EPI and the data that we have for action, specifically around infection prevention activities. And so there'd be work around developing what that plan would mean for Oregon, based upon guidance from CDC and other states, and based upon our own lessons learned from some several months of Ebola preparation. And we would be inviting new partners to join the subcommittee. So our preparedness and response folks, as mentioned, the liaisons who are out in the regions already and coordinate a lot of communication between EMS and hospitals and preparedness resources, whether it's for an infection or for a natural disaster. Our Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, which ORO, which works with nursing homes and non-hospital-based facilities in Oregon, and emergency medical services, and others as well. So a little bit more about this, the assessment hospital verification. So this would be a project that we would start working on this in April if we receive funding. And we would be using a verification or assessment tool that is based upon the CDC drafts that they were actually using for their treatment hospitals and other assessment hospitals already. And the model that they had there was that they were having to bring online all these hospitals to make sure they had the capacity to take care of these folks. And so they came up with some major domains that they felt were necessary in order to safely care for the patient and protect workers. And so these visits became, you know, a sharing and learning opportunity while following certain domain components. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So what this group would do is they would finalize the tool for Oregon use. We'd share the tool with the hospitals, the 7 assessment hospitals, and there would be an EPI team that would go out to and meet with the folks at each hospital and go through these verification visits, see what capacity they had, what resources they had, and which ones they needed. And there would be follow-up at 6 months and a year. And most likely there would be a summary report of what was found and lessons learned, mostly for sharing and understanding what barriers were there to know how to respond to NACUC in the future. And again, this is, I just want to emphasize, this is not a regulatory visit. Regulatory people would not be on the actual teams going to the hospital. It's really supposed to be to learn and to find out what needs to be done to improve. So some of the capabilities, and these are already can be found on the CDC website, and more details will be forthcoming when the tool is finalized. But it goes around, works mostly around, so patient transport, how does the patient safely get to the hospital, how are they received, what rooms would they be in, what waste management would work, the laboratory capacity, all the way down to communications and operations coordination. So very top to bottom. And as you can see, it's not just acute and communicable disease that's on here. We've got occupational health, environmental services, so that's where the multifaceted comes in. So that's the Ebola assessment hospital, mostly year one activity. And then the other second piece, as I mentioned before, would be this increasing infection control capacity and education around the state. And this is, I think, really exciting because hopefully this would be an opportunity to really assess our public health system and bring it up, just as the first presenter here talked today about sort of meeting some minimum capacities. So a lot of in the grant they talk about working to improve identification and response to healthcare associated infection outbreaks. So moving again beyond surveillance to actually identifying outbreaks and being able to intervene and working around building tools and educating. Also aligning our statutes. So we work, you know, a healthcare system as a whole in Oregon falls under different, our regulators with different agencies. And so how do we align our rules so that we're working together in the most efficient way possible? And then the other piece that they talk about a lot in the grant is around capacity building for emerging infections. And so that's where there would be sort of smaller assessments and verifications, again, non-regulatory, but done out in the different regions and different healthcare systems to help them coordinate what resources they have, what capacities they need to build in order to be to better identify emerging infections, how to work with their outpatient clinics, how to work with their EMS transport, how to work with their local regional hospital to better respond, identify high-risk patients, get them to the right care without infecting others. And part of that is improving communication. So that was that part that I kind of the overall gestalt I wanted to give about the Ebola grant. That we're still waiting to hear verification, but happy to answer questions about that.
Well, coming from a hospital that is one of the designated hospitals and being the one that's doing the drills and the simulations, it's complex, it's complicated, and if you're not doing it routinely, you forget bits and pieces. So I think this is going to be a great little partnership. I hope it works out. I think it would be wonderful to get other input, and I know that there's other hospitals in the cities that have done a lot of work as well. It'd be great to share learnings and see who's got best practices. So I think that would be great.
Yeah, and that's how we're hoping to do it, because we realize this is, you guys have done an amazing amount of work over the last several months and learned a lot. And so I think sharing would be, you know, best use of what you guys have done. And so that would be the hope, and that there would be folks coming in, learning, maybe, you know, cross-pollination.
Right. We even had the one rule out patient who was admitted to another hospital in the city. It'd be great to hear about their experience.
Exactly. So again, we're trying, that's the kind of idea that we're trying to foster with this.
And Jen, I wanted to also mention that on the first slide, it talked about the different, we have two other Ebola funding streams, one of which is going to the assessment hospital. So
we just made a decision this last week. We went out for partner input, and everybody kind of chose to give most of the money to the assessment hospital who stood up and said we'd like to do that. So right now we're having webinars to kind of talk about the details on that, but we're getting $74,000, which doesn't sound like a lot of money, and all of the whole of preparing that all the hospitals did. But we're giving $74,000 per hospital
and stepped up
and said that they would.
The biggest challenge from a hospital setting, and I'll tell you this across the board, is maintaining the state of readiness. Because you go back to your regular operations, and it's very difficult to strip away the resources that you need to produce one of these practice sessions, because it's labor intensive and resource intense to go through and simulate. Because we've done intubations and central line placements and Metro West delivering the patient, tracking the patient. So it's very intense. So it's very difficult, especially with low level activity in the community. It was very different last fall than it is now. So the sense of urgency is not as strong as it was.
We're hoping this fall that the funding will help. And then in Region 1, they're pulling all the coalition funds to them, put that out to the hospitals. And one of the part of our grant is a five-year grant, and we have to be testing and doing sort of, you know, either tabletop exercise or some kind of exercise regionally for the next 5 years to make sure that we are prepared and we're doing that. So that's part of our grant that we have on the HPP side of the house as well. So really excited to be able to work with Jen and her group, and we talked about having Jen come to our healthcare coalition meeting, which happen regionally, usually on a quarterly basis, and really kind of using those players already at the table at the regional level to really do some more, not just Ebola, because we obviously haven't seen it here yet, but, you know, on other types of infections and other types of things that might happen to Ebola. So this is a really kind of exciting, I think, springboard to what we're already doing with the healthcare coalition.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what we've learned a lot in ACDP is that there is already great regional work through trauma
advisory boards.
And so there's like, you know, how do you move a patient for trauma, or there's a lot of preparedness around non-infectious disease work that's been done and infrastructure that's already there. And so how do we build a medical or an infectious disease onto what's already existing and already has some great roots? So that's what we're learning to do here and work on these regions that are going to build on that. So
I have a question. I know you said this was a competitive grant. When will you know if you get it or not?
Right, we're getting.
I was told that we would know the final by the 30, around the 31st, so very soon.
How many grants are they awarding? I mean, is there a good chance?
So the problem, I think there's a good chance that every state will get some funding to do the hospital assessment verification, and it's more that second piece of building capacity that is the more competitive piece, if you will.
So, I mean, I'm very optimistic, and I think it's reasonably likely there were still a fair amount of states that are going to get the higher funding, and I know the CDC looks very highly on Oregon in terms of their HAI work, so I'm optimistic.
And I think also a piece with the hospital assessment, the question that's come up is that, you know, we want the tool has been recommended by CDC, but we definitely want to get, you know, stakeholder input as far as the hospital level participate with that. So that will be part of the subcommittee, the ICAP as they call it, will, you know, help take that input and then finalize the tool and get that to the hospitals. And so there's no, like, this isn't like a secret test. This is really going to be something collaborative. We'll have more a formal push out of information once you know about the grant. And I should say also that the three main EMS agencies that have stepped up to help transport patients who are being evaluated, they will also have an assessment as well, or verification capacity, if you will, as well. Again, we're trying to bridge those historically kind of different pieces, but kind of bring them together around.
Resilience too, because they're dialysis people.
A lot of blood. Yeah. Exactly. So, okay. So my last piece here, just move on here. Thank you, Mike and Kiko, for joining us. You guys. The next piece I wanted on the agenda was to talk about our Clostridium difficile initiative that we are working on here at the state. Chose this picture. This is a picture of the Natural History Museum in Paris, France, and just have the idea of looking at CBI from the inside out.
Where are we at night right now?
I think it's a sperm whale jaw, a mandible of a sperm whale jaw. But it's a very neat place. It's not often visited by tourists, but I highly recommend it. So, so I'll give a little context before I get to what's on the slide. We received a grant to work on Clostridium difficile and to really try to better understand transmission, interfacility communication, and how to decrease rates, not only in hospitals, but across the healthcare system. So really seeing nursing homes as partners in that. And so as part of the preparation work that we did over the fall, and thank you all for those who participated, we sent out HAI program surveys that not only asked you questions about carbapenem-resistant Enterobacter ACA, as we had done in 2012, but also some new questions around C. diff to try to get a broader idea of the capacities and current practices around Clostridium difficile. And so I wanted to just tell you a little bit about these surveys, and we've just closed, or we're finalizing getting the last folks together, but we'll be reviewing that data and working on that data in the months to come. But to give you some more context of what we're asking about, so it's not just hospitals, but skilled nursing facilities and laboratories answered questions about their infection control support time and staff around practices for screening for multi-drug resistant organisms and what precautions they typically used, whether it was an active infection or colonization. We're hoping that this will give us some better idea, because there's always, when we talk to nursing homes, we're like, well, we do it differently than hospitals, and hospitals are like, well, we do it differently than nursing homes. So we get a better understanding of the lay of the land so that we can, use the right language and make sure that we are cognizant of the different ways that they practice. We asked questions around intra-facility communication, about whether flags are used to notify providers about the presence of an MDRO. We also asked around Clostridium difficile, similar questions. We asked questions around policies and how they monitor adherence. So do they do observations? Do they use like ATP or Gloderm or things like this to verify that their environmental, that their housekeeping or environmental staff is cleaning well? We also have some questions around antibiotic stewardship, which is a big piece of all of our work here with HAI, especially around Clostridium difficile. And also some subjective questions about adequacy of response and facility support. And for the lab, we asked them more technical questions to see what they were testing with, which will help us understand some of the sensitivity and specificity of our surveillance. So again, we're hoping that this will give us a broader idea of what's going on around Oregon. So this is just a few of the questions and examples of what were used, or what we're asked of hospitals and nursing homes, mostly, not so much for the laboratories, but monitor, correct, et cetera. So right now we've received responses from all the hospitals have responded, I think, and then the labs were getting really close, and the same with skilled nursing. So we've been really happy with the responses, and thank everybody for their time in doing this. We hope to use this information from the surveys to then help the next part of the grant, which is we're going to be working hopefully in three different hospital skilled nursing partnerships in a couple different regions in Oregon, and really then take that deep dive, like I said, like going down to the insides about how do they identify DDI, how do they respond to it, test for it, what is their response, and work around developing and verifying best practices around infection control and also communication. And this comes out of a real need to better understand both transmission and prevention, because as we're learning from our own epi here in Oregon, at least 50% of cases originate in the community without any known contact with healthcare. So, and we know that just in general, there's lots of Clostridium reservoir in the dirt in the environment. But then somehow that comes into a healthcare facility and is amplified, and then they lead to transmission. So based upon those different pathways, how do we intervene through infection control, through antibiotic stewardship, both in the hospital and the community? So we're hoping to use these three different sites to look at slightly different pieces of that. I'm going down to Klamath County next week to work with their hospital skilled nursing, and they've wanted to work a lot on their outpatient antibiotic stewardship. So we're going to try to partner with our sister program here, another program here called the AWARE program, which focuses on outpatient antibiotic stewardship, and it has a lot of great materials for clinicians, practice guidelines, tools and education and communication for patients that's in a patient-friendly manner to set up expectations around antibiotic use. So try to bring that down there and see if we can expand that in the community there. So I guess just stay tuned and hopefully more about that later. And if people have any questions about that.
So in terms of C. diff, emerging C. diff, is it, do we still see an increasing evidence of increasing rate of C. diff across the country and across Oregon? Or is it too early to say for this year?
Oh gosh, for this year, there's a community and then there's
yeah, I'm just saying, you know, from hospitals, because people I'm talking to, hospitals, it's definitely a problem. People are increasingly aware because C. diff's always been around, but it's becoming obviously more and more something we're measuring and looking at and going after, detecting as early as we can. So we're looking harder, we're finding more. So I'm wondering if rates are going up across the board.
I mean, I think that on a national level, we're just now really getting good national estimates. I mean, there was a recent paper that we participated in the publication for as an EIP study. But that's kind of initial information on some level on a really good estimate for the burden. So, I mean, it's clearly a problem, but I don't know.
How many years of NHSN data do we have?
Well, we have
12, 13,
14. This will be our third.
And that's hospital, plus we have Klamath.
Right.
Which is both hospital and community.
I don't think it's been going up in Klamath, where we have our countywide surveillance in Klamath.
Yeah.
It's hard to know because they've also changed from the antigen to the PCR testing, so that, you know, created a little bit of a blip. So I think we're still somewhat figuring out what
it did actually increase, but I think that exactly what you were just saying, that it could well be due to the PCR, the change in testing
We know from England, you know, they did a very long study from, I think, 2007-2011, and they definitely saw decreases in rates as, you know, general infection control practices came in say hospital onset stuff. But we also noticed that even there will be the community, although it gradually decreased, there was definitely a large proportion, if you looked at those that were related, but in the community that did not change. So there's probably, their hypothesis is that there's a large permanent reservoir in the community, but you can make changes in your hospital to, if it's brought in, to prevent transmission and amplification. So there's always going to be some in the community. And that community piece might need to be changed by something widespread, like changing antibiotic prescription practices in the outpatient clinic, and sort of the antibiotic burden in the community, that kind of thing. So
how is
different levers for different studies.
How is the long-term care setting? I know that obviously there's a potential reservoir, and anytime you have that kind of situation, is there a way to even get a measurement there?
That's part of the program. So we're going to be working with those skilled nursing facilities that are piloting this program to get them enrolled in NHSN and start doing the surveillance, start doing the counting and understanding their burden. But yes, they're
with lab testing, you know, having worked at Pat, are you still on the phone?
Having seen the literature that 20-30% of our residents come in colonized. That's all I've seen so far.
Right, and so
they're a reservoir.
Right, exactly, and is it probably some of that's host factors because they're at risk, because they're ill, it's more common around elderly people, and there's all sorts of that, plus they probably just come from a place where they've had antibiotics, been very sick, you know, poor gut motility, all those things that...
Finding it in the food.
Right, food, or, you know, it's just there in the environment. So so one of the pieces that we want to discuss with, you know, say, can we do see what the rate of colonization is on entry, for example. So these are questions we'd like to be able to ask and kind of dive into it a little bit in Oregon.
I think getting the measurement is probably the hardest part.
It's a big part. It is. Because, I mean, NHSN, in a sense, it's not difficult in and of itself, but it is a new piece, and it can be clunky, and, you know, getting that into your daily routine when you've got everything else going on is challenging. So those are the kind of things.
What's the timeline of this work?
This grant is...
It's I think it's a five-year, most likely. So this is the first year, and we're kind of in the setup pilot stage at this point. We'll continue, likely, assuming we continue to get funding, but that's the general structure of it. I think it was five. It's either three or five.
Three or five years, yeah. We're in the sort of understanding the lay of the land, hence the survey, and looking at the kind of baseline.
Well, thank you. Any other questions? So, if we have anything anybody would like to add or share to the discussions before we adjourn?
Yes. I have one quick question. How do you screen for the CDF?
You need to have multiple episodes of liquid stools generally. The lab rejects anything that is not conforming to the shape of the container. So somebody coming in with abdominal pain, bloating, with recent antibiotic exposure perhaps, mostly that's the leading trigger for it, elderly, recent stay in a SNF or other healthcare facility, recent colonoscopy or other procedure. So those are all risk factors, and generally they're screened for in the emergency room. And usually
it's a testing. So there's symptoms. Usually there's symptoms of diarrhea, and that's where the testing comes from. The question of colonization is a different one, so that's if you're testing people who don't have any symptoms. And that's a different question. That would sort of be like, who's just carrying it in the community?
And how do you screen for that?
You have to do a culture. It's a similar test.
Is it random though?
The testing is not usually done. We don't recommend screening asymptomatic people unless it's in a study form. Most of the clostridium testing that we're talking about here that gets reported into the National Health Safety, though, should be done on symptomatic.
Because if they were asymptomatic, you probably wouldn't have runny stools, right?
Right, exactly. And there is like research being done about, you know, could those people be carriers and shedders, but that's still more in the research phase and not
so. So you want to identify them as early as possible so you can prevent contamination of the environment, because, you know, the more people going in and out of a patient room, if it's contaminated, the higher the risk of transporting it unknowingly around the.
And if they are colonized, is there any treatment?
Usually we don't treat people who are colonized. I mean, they don't have symptoms, so colonized meaning as if they don't have symptoms.
Right.
Because there's, you know, side effects, stand back, et cetera. But if they have symptoms of diarrhea, we absolutely treat them because they can progress to have very significant side effects. So you can very severe infection, perforate your bowel. You know, there's lots of other reasons. So if they're symptomatic, they're treated.
But what are they usually treated with?
It's different types of oral antibiotics, usually. Sometimes
fecal transplant.
Usually,
there's various flagellates.
You can use
the IV. They decided not to because they couldn't get the stools from someone.
I think it was the FDA approval is that you're talking about. Yeah. Maybe that there was, and I don't know what exactly.
I think it's still considered investigative, and so you screen
a donor. Usually they prefer their related.
And I think the research is very promising.
Right.
If they're doing more, they're also coming up with more reports of side effects as well, you know, unintended consequences. So that's why they're still. But yes, that does exist.
Yes.
But it's usually used when somebody has failed multiple courses of antibiotics.
But you know that you tend to get C. diff after a course of antibiotics wipes out all your normal flora. Well, the very antibiotics used to treat C. diff have been associated with getting C. diff.
Right, that's why we're wondering, what are they treating it with?
You wouldn't treat these asymptomatic people because you might give them disease.
But even if you are, even if you have the symptoms and then you get treated with it, doesn't that put you at higher risk?
Well, the treatment usually works, at least temporarily, but the organism sporulates and the spores aren't susceptible to the antibiotics, and so it's easy to get another episode the next time you get a course of antibiotics or even
it's down. Yeah, I think it's like 10 to 15% recurrence in different studies that people will be treated, but then it comes back, and the more it comes back, the more difficult to treat. So that's where the whole push for better antibiotic stewardship, not just in hospitals, but really in the outpatient clinic, decreasing the times that a person would come in contact with antibiotics should decrease their risk. So that's where that kind of work.
Okay, so I have a question since I'm a room of experts. I had an infection in my mouth,
And when I went to the endodontist, he used bleach to clean it out. And then I got a prescription for antibiotics, but I haven't started the antibiotics because I'm going to wait until I'm sure I really have to use it. Is that an effective treatment to use bleach in your mouth to instead of doing antibiotics?
I've never heard of it.
Really?
Wasn't
hydrogen
peroxide?
No, it's bleach.
I'd be afraid to give someone bleach to put in.
I asked another dentist, and he said, well, he said it's kind of nasty, even 1-20% diluted, but it's like, I've never heard of this, and I'm thinking, wow, if that's an effective way of treating an infection in your mouth, why are we all taking antibiotics?
So the periodontists are also treating a gum infection with diluted bleach now as well. So
I mean, bleach kills everything.
Yeah.
You know.
But it'll be a surface.
But would it get into the crevices between the teeth? I don't know.
It might be, I don't know. I mean, if it's something that's effective, it might be something to let people know that is a way to do it instead of going through the course of antibiotics.
Yeah, and they're trying to get, like, there's a lot of teaching around, say, cellulitis, you know, like the MRSA little boils, you know, that if you can just drain those boils and just provide good wound care, you might yet not need systemic antibiotics. But again, it all depends upon the type and the severity of the infection.
It's past 3:00, so we can keep any offline discussions if we want to.
But that's part of the education that we hope to do for patients and providers is to
Thank you, everybody.
Unnecessary antibiotics.
That's pretty interesting.